shorter. In other words,
this is starting near the end, but getting a little bit of the class.
That English, in terms of the number of words needed to communicate a concept, is because we have so many words, in that sense, if you want to communicate something precisely.
But that's not very useful for a second language, because people with a second language aren't going to learn 300,000 words.
But, well.
Don't you think that for a universal second language, you want a relatively small vocabulary? You don't mind if it takes you 15% more words to talk, if it saves you having to learn three times as many words. Look, yours is an argument which says that Chinese is the ideal written language. You know, one symbol per word. With the result that it's enormously difficult to learn to read and write Chinese, at least traditional Chinese. Anyway, the implication of this, the argument which a number of people have made, is that you have the possibility of what's referred to as path dependency, where if one of two or more alternative ways of doing something becomes dominant early on, you stick with it even if some better alternative is available. Now, this isn't exactly, this might or may not lead to a monopoly. In the case of Microsoft Word, it would give you a monopoly in word processors. In the case of QWERTY, nobody owns QWERTY, so it just gives you, the argument is, everybody using what was claimed to be a very inefficient typewriter layout instead of some more efficient typewriter layout. That's the claim that was made. And I suppose driving on the left in England provides a pretty persuasive example of that. That since everybody else drives on the left, if you're in England, you'd better drive on the left too. And yet, it is, I think, arguable and may well be true that everybody would be better if they switched to driving on the right, because now, rather than having to have cars especially manufactured for the English market, they could have better economies of scale, easier to handle. If they overproduce cars in Britain, they can sell some of them in France and vice versa. And of course, Sweden, as you may know, did switch some years ago from driving on the left to driving on the right. Now, the argument for, of course, the other argument, which is, was stronger for Sweden but is getting stronger for England now they've got a channel, is that if you do it differently than everybody else, then foreign drivers who come across to your country get into accidents. Your drivers get into accidents when they go into other countries, so easier to standardize. So then the basic argument is that you could have path-dependent outcomes where some random factor early on puts you on the wrong path, and then maybe there are ways of avoiding that. Maybe if the government said, all right, from now on all typewriters have to be Dvorak instead of QWERTY-OP, that would make us all better off, like the Swedish case. That's the basic version of the argument, and this was an argument which actually was made pretty seriously in the Microsoft antitrust case.
My computer has suddenly stopped responding. Did one of you put a magic spell on my computer? That's bizarre. All right. It's entirely stopped. All right, we're going to have a brief break while I reboot my computer. Sorry about that. Well, for a minute I thought I'd have to yank the battery.
That's a feature I wouldn't mind seeing on the laptop when the system freezes, the ability to power it down without popping the battery.
I just did.
I had a laptop like that that I could power down once the system crashed.
Yes, I don't guarantee that there are no circumstances in which you can't, because I think there have been times when I've had to pull the battery, but I just did restart it by holding down the turn on button for a while, and that did reboot the thing, despite the fact that the system had frozen for unknown reasons. Actually, I know why it froze. It just occurred to me. It's perfectly clear. This is the QWERTY-OP keyboard. Here I was insulting the QWERTY-OP keyboard. I was insulting this machine, and so of course it wouldn't go on with such nonsense. Perfectly reasonable behavior. I should have realized it. Sorry about that. Just a moment, and I will get back to where we were. Inside, do any of the rest of you have presentations ready yet? All right. Well, they are due, depending exactly where you are, but we're getting to the end, towards the end of things. So they should be in by now.
So this is the argument, and I think it's pretty clear that it's a theoretically possible argument. But then the next question is, how important is it? And the intellectual history here is that an economic historian at Stanford, whose name I should be able to remember, his last name is my first name. He's somebody David, but I forget his first name. Wrote stuff about the QWERTY keyboard, as did some other people, which made a whole bunch of historical assertions. The basic sort of story they told started with the idea that the QWERTY keyboard was designed to slow typists down because early typewriters, the keys jammed a lot. The next part of the story is the reason it took off was that there was a typing contest in which the world's only touch typist was working for the company that made QWERTY keyboards. And he won it, and that gave them a lot of prestige. And it was then claimed that once you had one standard keyboard, it was very hard for people to change keyboards. And the guts of it is that a fellow called Dvorak, somewhere I think in the 1930s or so, designed a different keyboard layout, which it was claimed is much better. They claimed it's easier to learn, type slots faster, and so forth and so on. And then a couple of economists, Leibowitz and Margolis, published an article in the Journal of Law and Econ called The Fable of the Keys. And this was sort of a play on a play on a famous work. The original thing was a poem written in the 18th century called The Fable of the Bees, which was arguing essentially that luxurious living was good for the economy. Not clear it was correct, but it was a famous poem. There was then a later economic article called The Fable of the Bees, which had to do with externalities in beekeeping. And then the Fable of the Keys. And the Fable of the Keys, Leibowitz and Margolis actually looked at the history carefully, which Peter David had never done. And in particular, part of the story was that the U.S. Navy during World War II had done a study of the Dvorak keyboard and had found that it was much, much better than the QWERTY keyboard. It turns out that at the time that this study was done, Mr. Dvorak was a member of the Navy employed to do studies like that. I don't think we've ever proved that he did the study, although it is very strongly suggested. And Leibowitz and Margolis managed to get a hold of the actual report of the study, which turned out to be pure advertising puffery. It did not, in fact, report a scientific study of the Dvorak keyboard. It said the Dvorak keyboard is wonderful. However, various other people had done such studies, because it occurred to various firms that hired a lot of typists that if the Dvorak keyboard was really better, their whole firm could switch to it and that would save them money, get typing faster and so forth. And the conclusion of the independent studies was that with the Dvorak keyboard you might type 2% faster than the QWERTY keyboard, but the differences were negligible. It also turned out that while it is true that the QWERTY keyboard was designed to prevent key jamming, it was designed to do it not by slowing the typist, but because the early typewriters, you had two banks of keys. And the idea was that QWERTY was designed so that two letters that usually came together would be on opposite sides of the keyboard.
Which you think would be more efficient.
That's right. You would think that would also be better for your hands. Right, you got it. Furthermore, it turned out that during the whole a good deal of the 19th century when people were using keyboards, the cost of rearranging your keyboard by resoldering the things on the arms was relatively low, that you could in fact get a specialized keyboard for an extra $5 or so. Of course, $5 was more then than it is now. And then perhaps the most striking evidence, which I don't remember if they discussed because it may not have been true then, is that once people switched to using computers, the cost of switching to a Dvorak keyboard was zero. That in fact, every Apple IIc made came with a little switch on it that would switch it from QWERTY to Dvorak, because whoever was designing that believed the story was QWERTY Dvorak. Nonetheless, almost nobody uses Dvorak layout. So it's reasonably clear that that particular example of path dependency was bogus. But very popular. And then the question is, what about the other examples? And Leibowitz and Margolis have a book whose title I've forgotten, but it's got Microsoft somewhere in the title, so you can find it if you wanted to look, on the general issue of network externality, which they've sort of made a specialty of theirs. And one of the points they make
is that if you have a product belonging to a single firm like Microsoft Word, and network externalities are really important and it's the dominant product, then people should be still willing to buy it instead of the competitors, even at a higher price, because it's more valuable. And therefore, what you ought to observe in that world is that the dominant product sells at a higher price, still is dominant, because you might as well exploit your monopoly if you've got it. And yet, empirically, that isn't true. And the claim they make, and they offer some evidence for, is that what's really going on with software is not a mainly a network externality issue, but mainly the fact that a given program is a natural monopoly, because once you've got it written, the cost of making additional copies is very, very close to zero. And that consequently, at any given time, there is usually a single dominant product, but it's a sequential monopoly, because if another company produces a similar product that is clearly better, now they suddenly get the monopoly, because now they can produce lots of copies and sell them cheaply. And they offer a number of examples. And the particular sort of bit of evidence they offered, which I thought was rather neat, was they looked at reviews of software in computer magazines. And they graphed some measure of how many of the reviews were favorable to what product against market share. And their conclusion was that what happened in a variety of niches they looked at was that at the point when a product came out that started getting consistently better reviews, suddenly market dominance shifted like in 6 months or so and the new product became the dominant one. And I've given some examples here. For those of you who remember long enough, the original spreadsheet was not Excel, it was VisiCalc. After VisiCalc, it was Lotus 1-2-3, and after Lotus 1-2-3, it was Excel, and similarly for word processors. Now, what is true is that Microsoft has ended up in both of those cases as the firm that's got the dominant product. And can make arguments about why that did or didn't happen, but at least their claim is that it wasn't really network externalities. All right, I think that finishes this topic. And before I go on to give you just a beginning of the next one, questions, comments, please remember that you are supposed to be doing your either in class or written or both reports, and you ought to be doing them by now because we're almost at the end of our topics, and you're supposed to do it about the time when the relevant topic is coming up. So, any questions on the antitrust stuff? No. All right. Antitrust was one of the first areas where law and econ sort of started getting a lot of attention, partly because of the kind of arguments I've suggested, but I'm not sure it's really one of the more interesting areas. All right, the next chapter is about one of the things that I've really found fun over many years, which is trying to use the intellectual tools of both economics and law to understand societies and legal systems other than ours. And for those of you who aren't third-year students, I expect to be teaching my seminar on this next year, as I taught it last year, called Legal Systems Very Different. And that seminar, we start out with modern gypsies, who have their own legal system. Nominally, they're under the same law as everybody else, but it's sort of hard to enforce laws on people when you don't know what their names are and when they trade names as convenient and they can trust each other and stuff like that. So gypsies have been pretty good at staying below the radar and then enforcing their own rules on each other. We go on to Imperial China, which is, loosely speaking, a legal system that lasted for 2,000 years, roughly. We know a good deal about it because it's been a literate society for all that time. And there's actually a book that we use in the seminar which has, I think, 190 cases from the last Chinese dynasty before the Republic and then the Communists back in the basically 18th and 19th century cases mostly. And that's a lot of fun to try to understand it. I've just been reading Marco Polo's Travels, which I never read and which turns out to be an interesting book. And he's describing the situation in China, I guess, in the later 13th century. And at least some of the elements he describes I can recognize from the discussion of 18th and 19th century Chinese law. That's sort of neat. We do a whole bunch of others. But the basic idea is that all societies have legal systems broadly defined, even anarchist societies. One of the societies we read a little about are the Plains Indians. And they range from a sort of rather limited beginning of a government, which exists mostly during the summer when the whole tribe is together, through more or less private action. That's the Cheyenne, which we spend most time on. But then, I'm trying to remember who it is. I want to say Apache, but I'm not sure that's right. Which was the Plains tribe, the southernmost of the Plains tribes, the one that was dealing with people in Texas and in raiding into Mexico? Anybody know? Anyway, whichever it was, it turns out they were literally anarchists. There was nothing you could recognize as the government. But they still really have a legal system, because there are still patterns of behavior. If you do this, that'll happen, and so forth. So that there are rules in effect. It's just that the rules aren't rules in the form of the government. So basically, all societies have legal systems. They all face about the same kinds of problems. They solve them in different ways. And trying to study them is partly a way of understanding, does economic analysis of law really work outside of modern Western, maybe Anglo-American legal systems? It's also, for me, an interesting way of thinking about ways we might improve our legal system. That in the case of, I guess, two and maybe three of the society, of the three societies discussed in the book, I got ideas from which it seems to me you can plausibly argue either explain features of our legal system or are ways in which our legal system could be improved. And at the same time, they also give you data. You can say, all right, if you have a legal system this way, what happens? What problems arise? How might those problems get solved? And so forth. And I originally got into this business. In fact, the way I ended up in a law school instead of an econ department is that I was in the econ department at VPI, and I read an article by Landis and Posner, which was a response to an article by Becker and Stigler, two very prominent economists, both of whom eventually got Nobel Prizes. And the Becker-Stigler article, although it wasn't put that way, was really arguing for replacing criminal law with something like tort law. And their argument they made was that the way criminal law is set up is in a certain way internally inconsistent because of the problem of the incentives of the enforcer. So if you imagine that I'm a cop and you're a criminal, I've got the goods on you, what's the effect of my turning you in and getting you convicted? You have a punishment that's equivalent to you to a $100,000 fine. I have a gold star on my report card, which gives me $10,000 future income because I've caught a criminal. From the standpoint of Dragnet, it's perfectly obvious. I turn you in and you get arrested. From the standpoint of an economist, it's perfectly obvious. I've got a pile of documents that'll put you in jail. That pile is worth $10,000 to me and $100,000 to you, and markets move goods to their highest valued use. All right. So the Becker-Stigler point was that given a system where the way we catch criminals is by having employees whose job it is to catch them, you have a serious problem preventing the employees from selling out to the criminals. How do you keep them from making a deal in the mutual interest of enforcer and enforcee, as it were? And that means that your legal system has to spend substantial resources on cops, watching cops, essentially. And maybe on other people watching them, because maybe it's the chief of police who's being selling out, so forth. And Landis and Posner wrote a response, and so Becker and Stigler said, well, there's a solution to this. The solution to this is stop paying policemen, and instead, when the policeman gets the guy convicted and he pays a $100,000 fine, the fine goes to the policeman. So now, but of course they've really, in effect, reinvented something like the tort system, where the guy who prosecutes collects damages. And the next step is, well, what if two policemen want to catch him? Well, how about we say the victim of the crime gets to decide who prosecutes him? Now it's almost completely reinvented the tort system. It's the victim of a tort who owns the claim and can then hire a lawyer to vindicate him, as it were. So, as I don't think in the first article they realized they were reinventing tort law, but they were thinking of it more as a bounty system. And Landis and Posner then wrote an article in which they raised a number of problems with this proposal and claimed to have a proof that you could not have an economically efficient system along those lines. A proof that a system in which the salary of the enforcer consisted of the fines paid or punishments paid by the criminals although it might possibly be better than the present system, because we don't know if the present system is economically efficient, was provably worse than a perfect criminal system. And I got interested, and I ended up writing two different articles. One of them is the one which you get a summary of in this chapter, because it occurred to me that I actually knew of a real-world society which had done what Becker and Stickler wanted to do, and that was Saga Period Iceland, where for a third of a millennium, if you killed somebody, his relatives sued you. And so I read the sagas, and I found all the secondary sources I could on that society, and tried to figure out how that legal system had dealt with the sorts of problems that Landis and Posner had raised, and with other problems you could imagine. And I wrote an article on that, which is an article I'm still very happy with. But I also found a solution to the theoretical problem that Landis and Posner had raised, and wrote a second independent article on basically economic theory, in which I think correctly claimed that the problem they had raised could be eliminated by a very small change in the institutions you were assuming, at which point, once that small change was made, automatically, as it were, you got the efficient result. And I submitted both of these articles to the Journal of Legal Studies, which at that time I think was being edited by Landis, and they got published, and they invited me to come to Chicago as a Olin Fellow in Law and Econ, which is what ended up switching me from doing other kinds of economics to doing law and econ. So played an interesting role in my life. And that was the Saga Period Icelandic article. And then a good deal later, I got interested in 18th century England for a different reason, which turned out actually to be sort of a red herring, but was lucky because it was an interesting system. Because there is a different article by Gary Becker, which raises a very simple sort of puzzle. And that is, you've got a criminal system, and a $1,000 fine imposed with certainty will have the same deterrent effect as a $2,000 fine imposed with 50% probability, or a $4,000 with one chance in four, or an $8,000 with one chance in 16. So Becker says, isn't it always better to increase the punishment and decrease the probability? Because you don't have to hire as many cops. The average punishment of the criminal is the same. There is, I think, a serious problem with that, which is not relevant. But the interesting bit that got me into this 18th century England was that the standard story you hear about 18th century English criminal law is that it's called the Bloody Code, in which almost all offenses were capital. And that looks like a real-world example of following up Becker's argument, impose the highest punishment you can impose, and then you don't need very much enforcement activity because you don't have to catch very many people in order for a small probability of a high punishment to deter them. So I wanted to figure out how 18th century English law worked, and I think I did, and I wrote a different article on that one. And you get a summary of that article in the chapter in the book as well. But it turns out that what was interesting about that, actually, was that 18th century England was more like Saga Period Iceland than you might think. Because in 18th century England, they had, on paper, a modern legal system with criminal law and tort law. The only thing is they didn't have any police, and they didn't have any public prosecutors. So the question was, how does criminal law get enforced? And the answer is, in practice, it's enforced by the victim. And that then raises an interesting puzzle, because in Iceland, if you steal my property or kill my relative and I sue you, when I win, you owe me some money. In America, if you commit a tort against me and I sue you, when I win, you owe me some money. But in 18th century England, if you steal my horse and I can prove you did it and I can get you convicted, they hang you. Doesn't do me any good. So the puzzle was, what was the incentive to enforce the law in 18th century England? It turned out there were a bunch of other puzzles that developed along the line. And you read the chapter, you'll see the sort of my answers to that. And then the third one is Shasta County, which is 2 hours from here or so, and which came out of not my research, but an interesting book done by Bob Ellickson, who's a law professor at Yale, in which he was looking at the system of private norms of neighborly behavior in Shasta County, which acted in effect as a privately enforced legal system, which in some contexts trumped the law of the state of California. So those are the three that I discussed in the chapter. And I created the seminar I've discussed basically because I thought I'd learned a lot and had a lot of fun trying to research Saga Period Iceland and 18th century England, and I hadn't done anything like that for 10 or 15 years, and it seemed like creating a seminar on legal systems different from Mars would give me an incentive to get back to work and learn some more interesting stuff. And on the whole, I think it's worked pretty well. Eventually, I hope to get a book out of it, but that'll probably take a while because I don't have enough unifying ideas yet to make it a book. Anyway, so that's what we're going to be doing next week. And I think by the end of next week, we're also going to be spending a little time looking at what I think of as the crime-tort puzzle, which is why do we have both criminal law and tort law? Why do they differ in the ways they do and so forth? And then, so those are the two chapters you're reading for next time. And I think for the benefit of my voice and your patience, I'm going to quit at this point. And instead of trying to do more of this stuff, which would only be 3 minutes on Iceland anyway.